السلام عليكم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Yeah, the focus really, can everybody hear me first of all? Yeah. Focus is going to be on media campaigning or campaigning using the media. And this being a human rights seminar, so really, I'm here really just to give you just a few tips on how you can project your voice, your concerns across to the media in the most effective manner. I've been involved with the Human Rights Commission, Islamic Human Rights Commission, now for a number of years. We work very closely together, me being a journalist, obviously interested in some of the same kinds of issues. It's been a learning experience for me, as much as it has been, I think, for some members of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, to see how we can, you know, use the medium of the mass media in this country to actually project our voice. It's very easy to fall into this sort of defeatist attitude, and you know, have this air of despondency. Nothing we say, nothing we're going to do will actually, you know, get across, because we're rowing against the tide. They're prejudiced, they're biased against us. But you know, in our own ways, I think we all have make small successes. We're chipping away at the barriers, as it were. I don't know how many of you actually take an active or hands-on approach to media campaigning, but the main sort of starting point for any campaign really is to identify. There's two things. Firstly, first of which is to identify your audience. Who is it that you're trying to reach? And that's important for a number of reasons. I mean, we're very clear in our own minds about what we want to do, about the message that we want, about the audience that we want to reach, who we want to target. But when it comes to actually implementing that on the ground, actually, you know, channeling our message to that particular audience, you need to have that know-how. You need to know how it's going to be done. You need to know what tools are available out there in society to be able to approach the right organisations, the right institutions, and you know whether it should be done on your own or whether you can bring a whole load of resources and coordination to bear on the situation. So all these various strands need to be tied together really to make your campaign, you know, have maximum impact. Because ultimately, what you want to have maximum impact. You want, if you're going to be using the media, you want to get your message across, and you want to get it across in the best possible way. You want to get it across to the most number of people. You want it to be effective. Now, who's your audience? When I was asked to do this, I had sort of visions of flip charts and PowerPoint presentations and so on. I've never been too sort of techie, but I think the best way really to explain it would be with reference to some of the human rights campaigns, or actually one of the campaigns that I've recently been involved in, which is with regard to Mauritius. I don't know whether many of you know what's happening there, but the leader of a political party called Hezbollah, no relation to the Lebanese Hezbollah, is on trial there. He's being stitched up basically for instructions to murder a political opponent or some activist for a rival political party. Yeah, I think, would you mind actually drawing it clear, because there's a lot of background noise, and I'm actually not very loud. That's only connected to the mini disc. It's for recording purposes only. If you can't hear me, just tell me and I'll try and speak up. But like I said, in Mauritius there's this activist who's been recently arrested, and he's been in prison now for 2 years. He's somebody who's been adopted by the Islamic Human Rights Commission as a prisoner of faith, and there's various ways that issue, I mean, it's something that the local people in Mauritius, the local Muslims, they constitute 18% of the population of Mauritius. They're a sizable minority, but again, they're in a minority, they're oppressed, there's not much they can do. They want international exposure. They want they want people in the international arena to know about the human rights abuses and the persecution, the oppression against the Muslim community that's going on there. But how do they get the message across? Now, I was sent out there as a journalist. There was a human rights observer as well, a lawyer who came out with me to observe the trial, actually talk to local people and see how we could air this elsewhere, give this issue an airing elsewhere. But first of all, once I got back here, having spent a couple of weeks out there, what you need to identify is who the hell is going to be interested in Mauritius. What does Mauritius tell you? If you're a human rights activist, you've got a tiny island, it's 1 million people. It gets half as many as half a million tourists a year. So people know Mauritius as a tourist idyll. It's one of these, island paradises where you go away for a couple of weeks, the honeymooners go. Nobody cares about it. As far as you're concerned, it's a, even on the even in on the world map, it's just a little speck in the sea somewhere. So why would anybody want to know about Mauritius? Now, how do you draw that to the attention of the British media? In fact, the international media hasn't covered the case at all. It's the biggest thing to happen in Mauritius for decades, actually. Some people say it's been the biggest case since for 100 years. So you've got to draw on really things that are of interest to the community. If you want to get this in the British papers, if you want to get the British media interested in this kind of issue in Mauritius, you've got to draw on what's relevant to them. So what is it about Mauritius? First, it's an island paradise. Okay, there's obvious themes that suggest themselves as a journalist, a human rights kind of trouble in paradise theme. It's not, underneath the surface things aren't what they seem to be. There's also the question of British tourists. How many British tourists every year go to Mauritius? In fact, the last time I checked, it was about 20,000 every year. That's quite a significant minority. Now, if they knew what was happening in Mauritius and how it persecutes people, a lot of people might have qualms, and it might play on their conscience to actually go and spend money in a place which is treating its minorities that badly. It might be a minority of people, but again, it's there. Also, recently, the government in Mauritius has used the spectre of the war on terror. It says we're conducting our own war on terror against the Hezbollah and against terrorists, and it's drawn up all kinds of fake scenarios where you've got, plots to contaminate the sugarcane plantations by people flying crop spraying machines, similar to the sort of American threats and so on. And so again, this is another theme that you could use. I mean, this is a very prominent theme of human rights activists at the moment, which were saying, well, the war on terror is being used as a pretext, for regimes to suppress political opposition. It's being used as an excuse to drown out the voice of rivals and to perpetrate human rights abuses. So we've got all these different. So if you just think, sat back and think about it, you've got two or three different strands that you can actually play on to draw the attention of the international media. And what's the second point or element really to any successful campaign, apart from the message? Sorry, apart from the audience, is your message. What is the message you're trying to get across? And sadly, we live in an age where the concentration span of people is, it's getting shorter all the time. Last time I checked, it was about 20 seconds, and it's getting lower and lower. So you need to be very, unfortunately, you've got to work within those confines. You can't have something that's, you can't have a document that's reams and reams long, because you're never going to be able to get your message across in 20 seconds on radio or on TV. So what's your message? Make it simple, make it direct. Most organizations or most people choose to approach the media, first of all, by way of a press release. It's the obvious choice, it's an obvious way. But I think, I'm an old-fashioned kind of person, and I think the more effective than that, first of all, is for your organization to actually make some links, develop some kind of contacts within, because the media is a vast sort of sprawling, complex. They get hundreds and, in fact, thousands of press releases every day from different organizations, each seeking publicity for their own cause. Apart from the, you know, hundreds and thousands of crank callers, they've got to feed a letter, an A4 page on a fax machine, rolling off a fax machine, is just another story as far as they're concerned. It's just, you know, another event. What makes that event stand out? Now, if you have a personal relationship or a personal contact with anybody else, with any a journalist, for instance, a desk editor, or, you know, somebody that you've actually taken out to dinner once in a while and said, look, you know, I'm a very keen observer of what's going on in Mauritius. It's something that your foreign desk needs to keep an eye on. As somebody who's quite familiar with what's going on there, I can offer you something. I can keep you in the picture. I can keep you in the know. As soon as there are any developments in this country, in this particular case, I can tell you. You'll be the first person to know. You'll be the journalist who gets the exclusive on this, and this is what journalists want. So there's nothing that beats really developing some kind of a relationship with the with media organisations. You know, I mean, it's no use. As I don't think that we've got any benefit in running to, you know, Barbara Amiel from the Telegraph or Polly Toynbee from the Guardian. So identify sympathetic voices or people who are potentially sympathetic and who have an interest. Even a passing interest in these affairs, and approach them. Don't be shy, you know. Say, look, I've got a story for you. If you have to pump it up. Say, you know, it's an exclusive. You know, it's nobody's got a hold of it. And you know, if you have to let them down, if it's an anticlimax for them at the dinner table, then fine. At least you've given it a try. When that press release rolls off the fax machine, it's directed to. Let's give you an example. Joe Bloggs at the Guardian. It's got his name on it, and he thinks, all right, you know, Ahmadi. I've met brother. I've met Ahmadi. Yeah, he seemed all right. What's he saying? He's going to look at it. You know, he's not going to look at it 6 hours later or 7 hours later or the next day after he's done his stint. He's going to look at it there and then, and he's going to say, yeah, okay, yeah, possible. He might ring you. He might not do. But at least you've got that. You know, you've got past that first stage. When it comes to doing press releases themselves, a lot of I get asked quite regularly to do press releases for various organisations, and I get, in fact, more often than not, I get asked to edit press releases where other people have written. It's something that you've got to learn. It's not something that's, you know, it's something that's acquired. It's not something that comes naturally. A good press release has to be no longer than a side of A4. Within that, it's got to be no longer than 5 or 6 paragraphs. It shouldn't contain more than 1 or 2 ideas. Sometimes we forget, we're so familiar with an issue, we have so much, we're so intimate with them. You know, with an event, that something that strikes us as being very, very important to a journalist or to somebody else would be detail to the lay observer. We've got to isolate the wheat from the chaff. We've got to take out the important bits. And the secret to writing a press release is to get 1 or 2 ideas. And write the press release, the paragraphs in descending order of importance. So, you know, in Mauritius, for instance, somebody has been in jail for 2 years. Now, the story is not, if somebody's been in jail for 2 years, a journalist doesn't want to know that somebody's been in jail for 2 years. Because that's not news, because they'll say, the first thing a journalist will say, well, this is 2 years old, this story. This guy's been stitched up, and it happened 2 years ago. Well, what is there that's going to strike my interest? What is there that's going to make my name? I mean, unfortunately, this is the way that the world works, you know. What is it that's going to make my name as a journalist? So you have to identify something which is current, which is going to give a fresh perspective on an old story. In the case of Mauritius, yeah, I give you the example of the war on terror. There might be a decision coming up in the court, for instance. Or there might have been a demonstration surrounding the courtroom the previous day, you know, which a number of people got arrested, and there were further human rights abuses taking place. So you've got to give the journalist something that's fresh. And with human rights cases, especially some of the ones that a lot of the cases or issues that Muslims take up, there have been issues that are long running. They've been there in the public, or they've been, you know, going on for a long, long time. So the chances are that they're not going to be fresh, they're not going to be current news, you know. So you have to, you know, sometimes you, as a journalist, you find yourself actually not concocting, but sometimes almost, you know, sort of trying to, you know, drag out or pull out a fresh perspective on an old story, you know, which is perhaps not there. But it's all in the interest of making something sound or look current. Because news, which is 2 years old, isn't news. You know, it's archive. When you write a press release, once you've written it, it's ready to go off. Always, never make the mistake of just sending it to the organisation concerned. Find out who it is who deals with that issue. Talk to them first of all. Even if you haven't got a personal contact, establish telephone contact and say, I'm such and such a person, I'm going to be sending you a press release about an issue. So they know it's coming through. And it's directed to somebody, it won't get lost in the mountain of paper at the newspaper. Always leave a telephone number. A lot of, you'll be amazed at the number of press releases I've read which don't have any sort of contact details at the bottom of them. Always make sure that the numbers and the details that you give are for a person who is accessible, you know. It's these journalists, they operate to yesterday's deadlines, you know, they operate to really, really tight schedules. So if I've got a deadline of 5 o'clock, or, you know, if I've got a few minutes in which to find out more about an issue, and I can't get you on the phone, I can't, you know, get an email to you because it's bouncing back, your email, but your Hotmail's full, then sorry, you know, you had your chance, mate, you blew it. And honestly, it really is that ruthless. It's almost like a make or break. The press release, really, for me, is almost like it's a make or break document. You know, it's something which is either going to get you noticed, or it's going to get your issue some prominence, or it's just going to be discarded. They do, but, you know, they've got to be. If you send an A4 piece of paper with a few paragraphs on it typed, you know, without a header, without any sort of, it doesn't look official, it looks as though it's just suddenly been, or very quickly been, typed up in Word or something and faxed across, then people are going to take it less seriously. But I mean, so take it from Phocis, yeah. You know, but if it's on Phocis headed paper, you know, with all due respect, nobody takes Phocis seriously. but, you know, if it's on headed paper, if it looks official, you know, if it's got some names on it, the name of the chair or the media spokesperson, then somebody's going to say, oh, right, okay, well, here, somebody's made an effort here, and this looks like a bona fide organisation. You know, it's a representative body of students on campus. Yeah, I should give them a ring. They do work. They do work. I mean, it's a primary approach mechanism or approach method that the organisations use. No, go on, carry on. Sure.
As compared to lobbying to sort of register your approval or disapproval of what someone's written, I would have thought.
No, the whole. The whole reason I'm focusing on media campaigning as opposed to lobbying is that lobbying, for me, tends to be reactive. The kind of thing that is MPAC do and. Other organisations, okay, there's a role for that, but in terms of actually raising your own issue, putting your, you know, forcing your own issues onto the agenda.
Sure, I mean, you mean reacting to an article or to a particular coverage?
Is that what you're referring to?
Well, it can be proactive as well.
Well, lobbying can be proactive,
yeah.
But again, you know, you in order to be able to sort of get the media's attention, you have to follow, you know, certain, you know, procedures. certain methods, you know, a press release, a press conference, for instance.
I'm thinking more in terms of, sorry to interrupt, but like, for example, you know, like when they have something very pro-Palestinian, they'll get 200 or 300 letters of complaint the next day, whereas the Muslims don't support these kind of articles, and conversely, they don't complain enough about anti-Islam coverage. So do you think that's something that
it's probably
should be doing more?
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's actually not true. Muslims do complain and they do react. It's just that their voices don't get a, you know, sort of, they just don't have as much impact as the others. At the end of the day, you've got to also realise that a lot is dependent on the, you know, the people inside the media organisations. You know, we are less powerful than other lobbies, you know, despite, I mean, we're less organized than other lobbies, but I think that's changing. But at the same time, we are definitely less powerful. So, I mean, you've got to work within your own limitations. You've got to recognize your limitations, but don't let that be a barrier. See that as a hurdle, see that as a challenge. Once you've actually got past, feel free to interject with your questions, but once you've got past the press release, let's just give an example of Phocis and perhaps Manchester University are organising some kind of massive motion, and you know, the Zionist lobby is kicking up a fuss that this is anti-Semitic and so on and so forth. And let's say the Daily Telegraph decide to say, oh right, you know, we've got, the only thing we've got from any Muslim organisation here is from Phocis, and yeah, we do need a Muslim voice here, so let's give them a ring. Now, it's no use having five or six numbers of the Islamic Society, Manchester University Islamic Society, on there, and somebody ringing up a couple of numbers, speaking to two or three different people, and getting two or three different messages. Everybody in the organisation should be on message. The best way to do it is to have one media spokesman. If you don't have a media spokesman, have if you know, if students are always too busy or not available, have two, but make sure they are giving the same message. You don't want, the last thing you want is contradictory messages going out. I mean, this is something I've had to deal with recently with Umma News website. It's a very sort of poorly resourced and very poorly managed affair, simply because we don't have the funds. But we had a Daily Telegraph ringing us up, and a Sunday Telegraph saying, Our website had crashed. We had a hard drive crash. We've been under pressure from Zionist organisations who want to see us closed down because of some of the coverage we had, and they must have contacted the newspapers and said, "Umma News has been closed down. We're off the web now. We're offline." And I was in Holland. I got a call from the Sunday Telegraph saying, "All right, Umma News has been closed down by the British government." I said, "Hold on a minute. That's news to me." Last I heard, it was there was a hard drive crash, and so what they'd also done in my absence was they'd phoned up the manager of Umma News, they'd phoned up somebody else who was involved as an activist raising money for Umma News, and I didn't know what message they'd got from them. See, what they were concerned about was that we have a sister site called umma.com, and there's a message board on there, and somebody had written appealing for funds for to help the Mujahideen in Indonesia in the troubles in the Malaccas Islands, and they were connecting the two. Now, see, the sister who they'd originally contacted, who was responsible for putting up this message, had spoken 15 minutes with a journalist without having a clue, you know, what this person's agenda was, because she wasn't in the picture. So everybody's got to be on message. It's got to be very tightly. So, I mean, for that to happen, you've got to have a very, very tightly organised unit. You know, it's very, very tempting for somebody who's not dealt with the media to, you know, to be sort of very flattered by a sudden telephone call from somebody important in Fleet Street, and say, he was asking them questions about the organisation, about something, and you know, we're Muslims. Yes, you know, we try to be modest. We try to hide our light under a bushel, but at the same time, everybody's human, and you know, the last thing you want is to have your message distorted, or the chance to have your message aired undermined, really, and destroyed by somebody making a loose comment, you know, and off guard or offhanded comment. So make sure that you have a media spokesman, which is there's ways that you have to deal with an interviewer, with somebody, with a journalist, and you know, we all know that the a lot of the time the stories tend to be fitted around, you know, or framed around agendas that aren't really our agendas. For instance, just to give you a sort of current example, if somebody I heard a BBC interview with somebody who purports to be the official spokesman for Aslan Maskhadov, the Chechen president, and this was only yesterday on BBC, the day before yesterday on BBC Online. And I don't know, you know, whether I suspect this guy's claims aren't true, but the line he was giving was not something as a Muslim or human rights activist I would give. You know, he was actually playing to the sort of you know, war on terror agenda, as it were. I mean, we know for a fact, looking at the media coverage of what's going on, what went on in Moscow over the weekend, that this was, you know, being squeezed into this, you know, war on terror agenda. We knew, we saw how the media were trying to shoehorn this whole thing into another sort of example of, you know, extremist Muslim terrorism. And in fact, most of the coverage was actually disgraceful. On the BBC Online, one of the journalists was talking about how these hostages were terrified, they're terrorized, got no access to water, no access to latrines, they've got no infrastructure there. They've got, you know, they're absolutely terrified. Now, if I was a human rights activist, and a Muslim to boot, and somebody and a journalist came to me, what message would I want to get across and say, look, as a Muslim, how do you feel about this? You know, how would you tackle it? You know, their objective really is to put you on the defensive. I mean, you know, a lot of the time, I mean, 90% of the time, the objective of the media, or the position of the media, the attitude of the media, is with a pro-state bias. You know, whether it's the Independent, the Guardian, it is very, very pro-establishment. Now, if you answer the question as put to you, you know, what do you think about this outrage? If you answer it directly, all you're doing is you're reinforcing that attitude, you're reinforcing that agenda. Whereas what you can say is, well, yes, these people are terrified, and these people, you know, have had their lives sort of suddenly disrupted and in fact destroyed or pulled apart around them. But what's been happening in Chechnya for the last 2 years or for the last 10 years? Are the people who have had their houses bombarded, or the 30,000 people who die in Chechnya every year, are they any less victims of terrorism? You know, they don't have access to clean water. They don't even have decent housing. They have to live under constant threat of military siege, under constant military siege. They can't walk in the streets. They're victims of terrorism too. So this is the message that you want to get across as a Muslim human rights activist, is something, or which really is, falls into a different agenda altogether. Now the trick is not to fall into the, you know, into line, as it were, even with the journalist's agenda, just by simply answering the questions. When you're being interviewed, what you want, first of all, is to actually go in there equipped with a list of points that you have to make, or you want to make. And regardless, you'll see the best people, best politicians always do this. Actually, question time is a good way to learn. Analyze how the respondents reply, and whether they tackle the question directly. You know, I'd say 90% of the best politicians, 90% of the time, the best politicians don't. They answer it completely differently. And they do it in a way that gets their point across without answering the question. Because ultimately, that's what you're there for. You're not there because you want to get your, you know, mummy wants to see your face on TV, or, you know, you want to sound good on radio. You're there because you want to get a message across. And don't let the interviewer dictate what you're going to say. You dictate the terms of that interview. It might be that if it's an edited interview, they won't publish any of it, they won't broadcast any of it. But at least you've gone in there and you've tried your best. The other thing, which is quite important, I think it's the final point I want to make, is I talked about the shortening concentration span of people and the dumbing down of TV and radio and journalism. So prepare some sound bites, because all journalists, they love good sound bites. So prepare a phrase or a few phrases or a few quotations, which might be entertaining, might be even have a little bit of humour in them, but which are going to sound good, and people are going to say, that's clever, or it's quite witty. It's something that journalists actually, sometimes they can't resist using, just because they might not be very deep and meaningful, but they're definitely entertaining. So your message has got to include those ingredients. And if anybody's got any questions about campaigning and about approaching the media, feel free to ask me. The Muslim media. Well, I've been talking largely about the non-Muslim. Sorry, I've been talking about the non-Muslim media implicitly. The Muslim media is very much easier to access for us, because there's not much of it. Two, they don't have an awful lot of material. It's very. We have one newspaper, which is a monthly newspaper, which is a Muslim news. There was a magazine, a newspaper which became a magazine, Q News, which is publishing more infrequently now. I know there's a sort of whole, there's about 20 or so Ramadan radio stations that are about to spring up now in the next couple of weeks for Ramadan. It depends what your audience is. If you want your message to get across to a Muslim audience, then this is what you've got to approach. It's like, it's like commerce, it's like business. You're a businessman, you're selling TVs. You don't want to be advertising to blind people, you want somewhere that's people are going to see your adverts. You want to put your money where it's going to get the maximum return.
Division from the community, the Muslim community in the UK, for example, there's the Deobandi Muslim community. I think they're very hard to get in touch with. How do you recommend that we get in touch with those sort of people and get these issues to light? Because at the end of the day, these Muslim organisations, they're very inactive and they all have the same methodology and ideology. I mean, how do you recommend that we, or in general, Muslims, activate these people and access them? Because there must be a method in the way.
Well, if you're talking about internal dynamics and, actually activating, sleeping, forces, then this is something that you're going to have to do at a grassroots level, and I can't see how you're going to use the non-Muslim media really to do that. But if you
use that to stuff like that. Not the non-Muslim media, the Muslim organisation. It's not a first. It's just a general issue. For example, there's this Palestine campaign that should affect all Muslims across the UK. How do you get in touch with the majority of Muslims, right? Which I see as Indian Pakistani based, 70% of those in this country are from that. What sort of tips do you have, or how do you recommend getting in touch with them?
I think it's more of a market research question, but I mean, how do you get in touch with the majority of Muslims in this country? Now, in fact, it's good marketing. good research. You have people on the ground in each community. You have links, contacts. If you have the resources to publish a newsletter of some sort, get some leafleting out, emailing, sending out mail shots, and so on and so forth. All these kinds of sort of devices can be used. Sorry, sir.
How can we complain against the fraudulent labeling?
Yeah, this is something that you've just got to.
What is the most effective way?
Most organized. Yeah. I think I'm not the best person to answer that. Masood will probably, because Masood from the Islamic Human Rights Commission deals, sort of very in a very hands-on way with sort of wrong labelling and so on. I'm a journalist, but I know that many organisations do send out circulars. If something like, I know I received one from Hizb ut-Tahrir just a couple of days ago. After Brian Sewell wrote in the Evening Standard, he called Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam an imperialist, and he made some other disparaging remarks about the Prophet. So they sent a letter, an open letter to the Evening Standard, which they then copied on their mailing list to everybody. I don't know how many thousands of people it reaches, but again, that has the effect of encouraging people like myself, ordinary people, to write into the Evening Standard, who weren't perhaps aware of this article. To write in and complain. There are lobbying organisations which lobby specifically on this kind of issue, and I mean, again, there's no harm in being proactive about it, not simply complaining once an article has been published. I know some organisations have sought meetings with editors and so on, and complained about the use of the word terrorist, for instance, use of the word Islamic in front of terrorists, the use of terms like Muslim extremist, to come to some kind of common or acceptable definition of what constitutes terrorism and how, in what context these words are going to be used. But in order to be able to achieve some kind of success on this front, you need to be organized. You need to have organized groups with some kind of, which carry some kind of clout, and groups which are going to have as their aim, to get some kind of influence amongst editors, to get some kind of a change in the way that they're using phrases and using words. Islamic Human Rights Commission is one. There's MPAC, which is a new one. It's been set up. There's another Muslim Council of Britain. They do certain things. They have regular, they seek meetings with editors and so on. So I mean, join one of these groups. Or if you think none of them are doing anything worth shouting about, then develop your own group. And most journalists, I mean, will if you have a body behind you, if you're more than one individual, and you've got a legitimate concern, most journalists will see you, they'll talk to you. They might not agree with what you say, they might not take up your recommendations, but they'll certainly speak to you. Everybody wants to be famous. If you have a group of people, like I said, the best thing to do is, most effective thing to do is to elect or appoint a media spokesman, and find somebody who's articulate. Find somebody who's got a, get somebody who's got. Don't get the quiet one in the group. Get somebody who's got the gift of the gab. Give. No, well, you've also got to find somebody who won't let power get to fame get to his head. And it's important, I mean, if you think that that's going to be a danger, then have some kind of mechanism whereby he's accountable to the group. And, it's easily done. But ultimately, you know, as Muslims, we've all got to remember that we're accountable to Allah, and you know, the reason that we're doing this is to promote a particular cause, promote a particular issue, and not ourselves. So you know, there's no substitute for piety and modesty. You know, unfortunately, you've just got to find somebody who's capable of doing the job and somebody who's going to, you know, do it effectively without really, you know, he's going to serve the interests of the group, the cause, rather than promote himself.
If I may, broader mission, I came just to be more aware of the organization. It's quite clear there is a global war on Islam raging. I don't know whether you have a view on this or a
answer. We all do.
But that's not the point. The point is, in a context of a global war and the role of the media, in which Muslim communities and the ideology of Islam is under attack. You know, we had neighbors the other day, you know, they're coming left, right, center, terrorism, anti-Islam, the lot. This is building up, I think, into a dangerous situation. And that's the point I was trying to, I think there needs to be a campaign on this actually. Not so much how to use the media. Many of us, I remember QNews being set up. Day one is, I think the issue is how the Muslim intelligentsia needs to awaken. We have people who are in positions of authority, who are articulate, but who do not want to be seen, yeah, to be making a noise or rocking the boat. I think the community is in a very dangerous situation of demonization in this country and globally, obviously. And I don't know whether there is a solution to it. You know, it's a global war. In that situation, there's going to be casualties. And I said this point at the beginning. I think there's a twin track that needs to be adopted. In this case, it's our own media, but I'm not rubbishing. You know,
mass media.
But all I would say is two points. One is the situation is changing, and everyone needs to be aware of it. But I think the role of the Muslim intelligentsia in this country has to be really mobilized. I think the time's come. There's many people like ourselves who are educated, who are British, who've got no fear of nationality or being deported, you know, just because we've been here for 1 year. Some have been here for several generations. So there shouldn't be a fear there, right, about deportation. We're not asylum seekers. But more importantly is the issue of, you know, making the professional class in this country, and there is a professional class, I don't want to use the word middle class, but professional class, to be mobilized, and that has to be done globally. I think that's the issue. And the Muslim media, I think that is an issue. I think, you know, if we can have Al Jazeera, alhamdulillah, that needs to be internationalized. We need to really develop.
I mean, I say this, you know, time and time again, that there's no getting around the necessity for an independent Muslim media. You know, you can have as many voices as you like penetrating the Western media, but ultimately things, they're serving a different agenda. You know, they're looking at, you know, unless and until you have Muslims dominating the mainstream media, in which case it won't be a mainstream media, it'll be a Muslim media, you're not going to have any influence in the mainstream media. You're not going to change people's minds. Now, for, you know, one of the great advantages of this sort of sudden this IT revolution has been the ease with which people can use the new technologies to relay their own voice, using the internet, using, you know, streaming methods. You know, even, you know, it cost, somebody told me it cost about £20,000 to set up a satellite TV station. You know, we're talking about economies of scale here, which have come crashing down since the IT in the IT revolution. And you know, ultimately, it is going to have to be the Muslim professional classes, the moneyed Muslims, who are going to have to support these ventures. Okay, they've become cheaper, but you know, even a satellite station or a website, it's out of the range of, you know, one person or a couple of individuals. One of the advantages, or the main advantages, is that you get what I would call an unadulterated voice Islamic voice across to people. And you'd be surprised at the number of people who actually access, non-Muslim people who also access Muslim media and alternative media for their news sources. I mean, I run ummanews.com, we're not big, 75,000 hits a week, but you know, over the course of 18 months I've had like, you know, it's a trickle of readers, not non-Muslim readers, who've written back and said, well, you know, I don't agree with everything you carry here. Some of it seems quite outrageous, some of it seems, you know, utterly rubbish, but it's a very important source of news for me to get the other perspective, as it were. So in order to be able to get the Muslim perspective across, we can't rely solely on the mainstream media. We have to support the you know, attempts to create an independent Muslim media in this country. There's no two ways about it, and I find it's quite saddening, it's quite disheartening to see the number one complaint you get everywhere is, oh brother, we have no influence in the media, the Muslims, you know, always get rubbished in the media, we're demonized, we have no journalists, we have no editors, you know, how come when we have somebody on Question Time it's, you know, Yasmin Ali by Brown, or you know, somebody who's not really not kosher enough, not one of us. And but the, you know, my response to this is always that you've got to create, you've got to generate your own spokespeople, you know, you've got to strengthen them, and strengthening them means actually supporting people. So you know there are lots of Muslims out there who are lost. There's lots of Muslim journalists who are lost in the BBC, they're lost in the Guardian, they're just keeping their head down. They've almost become, you can use the word Westoxicated, you know, they've conformed because they need to get on in the, they need to get on in the career. But had they gone into the Guardian and the BBC from a position of strength, and had a community, had some bodies behind them who said, well, you know, this is if you adopt such and had they adopted such and such a position, a strong position, anti-war position, for instance, or anti-Israeli position, and they would have the support of the Muslim community and this organisation and that organisation. We've got money behind them as well. They won't have to worry about the mortgage being affected, or you know, how they're going to support their families. Then these people will be, you know, more inclined to be helpful. So you do need that. You know, you need to put your money in your just. Muslims need to put their money in their their hands in their pockets, and actually fork out and develop their own institutions. You know, this is the only way. And Al Jazeera is a good example, because it showed. Okay, ultimately it was it's a Qatari government which is bankrolling it, but it showed just what can be done if you set your mind to it.